Welcome to Songcraft. I'm Paul Duncan.
And I'm Scott B. Bomar. You're listening to the song De Friends Fall in Love, written by Vilry and performed by the duo of Rachel and Vilry, who join us on this episode of Songcraft.
Two friends, two hearts, too many nights to count them. But tonight was something new, and I know you felt it too, when we fell into the passion of a kiss.
Rachel and Vilry first met when they were both students at the New England Conservatory of Music. Rachel Price went on to form the band Lake Street Dive with their fellow students Michael Calabrese, Bridget Carney, and Mike McDuck Olson, while Vilry developed his own path as a solo performer. Inspired by a shared love of classic Tin Pan Alley pop standards, the duo came together in 2015, eventually signing with Nonesuch Records. They released their self-titled debut in 2019 and the more elaborately produced I Love a Love Song album earlier this year. While Rachel contributes as a songwriter in other contexts, vocalist and guitarist Vilry is the sole writer of the duo's original songs. Heavily steeped in classic songwriting traditions with a contemporary flourish, the music of Rachel and Vilry is simultaneously fresh and timeless. The pair joined me for a conversation about songwriting and song interpretation earlier this year when I Love a Love Song was first released.
Part 1.
So, Paul, you are an active professional songwriter.
Thank you.
That is, well, I mean, it's, you know, I didn't say I like your songs.
Try to stay active.
You're a professional songwriter. That is your life. That is your career, your profession. I was a semi-professional songwriter at one point, meaning that I was actually doing it for a living. I just wasn't having much success. But about 20 years ago, I remember learning an important lesson. I wrote with a guy who had some real serious success, and he and I wrote a song that I thought was pretty good. We wrote it in Nashville. I came home to Los Angeles. I had a little studio set up in my garage. You might remember at my old house. I had this little, you know, garage studio. We made some fine recordings.
We sure did.
In there. And so I demoed this song. The song was called 12 Bar Blues.
I remember this
and
song.
It was a country song, and it was about, you know, I'm going to 12 bars, you know, but it's a play on, you know, whatever. It was cute. It was a decent little song. So at the time, I was a staff writer for Sony in Nashville, and there was a guy at Sony Nashville named Rex, and he was a super talented guy, and he ran the demo studio at Sony there, and you could take Rex like an idea, and he would make this incredible, you know, full sounding demo of it. And so I came home from this trip, and I did a demo of 12 Bar Blues, and I spent a lot of time kind of playing these bluesy guitar licks and this sort of stuff. And I made this whole demo and I took it back the next time I went to Nashville and I played it for the guy that I co-wrote the song with. And he listens to the whole thing. Now I had spent a good bit of time on this. He listens to the whole thing. He goes, "Scotty, this is why we have Rex." I was like, ouch. But I also knew he was right.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was like, this demo that I made does not sound as good as the demos that Rex was making and that other people in Nashville were making. And I learned an important lesson in that moment, which was, I'm a songwriter. Don't try to be Rex.
Yeah.
And I would say it's rare the person who can really be a great songwriter and a great producer. And so maybe you're out there listening to this and you've written a great song. Don't try to be Rex.
Right.
You gotta get your own Rex. And the best Rex that I know of nowadays, who services not only Nashville, but the entire world, is our friend Justin.
That's
at
right.
Pearl Snap Studios. Tell the folks a little about Justin and what it is that he does.
Well, Justin, he's just sitting there waiting for your email right now. What he's doing right now is looking at his laptop, waiting for a submission to come in, and he jumps into action as soon as he does. You send in a song, and then Justin goes down into the Batcave and turns into Rex. Justin and the team of producers at Pearl Snap Studios can take your song from its elemental, primitive stages and turn it into a fully realized, fully fleshed out, beautifully played recording that you're ready to pitch, that's probably ready to get played on the radio if you have that avenue. But Pearl Snap Studios is a way to keep yourself from getting wrecked. You know what I'm saying? Like, they can Rex your song so you don't get wrecked. Is that
helpful? I think there's something there. Yeah. No, there's nothing there. So let's just take a little moment here, listener, and I want you to pretend like you just played me the new song that you wrote and made a demo of, and we're just gonna give it a beat. And we're gonna pretend like I just got done hearing it. Okay, you know what, buddy? This is why we have Justin. This is why we have Pearl Snap. See, it's tough, right? It's tough love. I had to hear it. It wasn't easy for me to hear
it.
It kind
of hurt me to hear it.
Kind of hurts. But man, sometimes the truth hurts. Yeah. So quit messing around with Pro Tools. Quit messing around trying to make a demo that you think is going to work. Just call Justin. Call Pearl Snap. PearlSnapStudios.com. Tell them Songcraft sent you. You get a discount if it's your first time. You will not be disappointed.
So Scott, I got a question for you, and I haven't prepped you for this at all.
You have not.
So we're just going right in. How many songs do you think that you could name just by the opening drum beat? I'm talking about songs that open with drums, either a fill or a beat or something. And there's nothing before the drums, just drums.
Oh, man. Well, okay.
How many songs do you think do that? And how many do you think you can name that do that?
Man, I mean, I'm just trying to think of examples right now. I'm thinking of Tom Sawyer by Rush. I think that starts with drums. I'm thinking
it doesn't.
Does it not?
It's got a synth at the same time.
Okay, so far I'm 0 for 1.
Yeah.
I could think of like, is My Girl? There's some Motown iconic fill that kind of opens, brings us into the song.
I don't have that one. I know what you're talking about.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I would be a little nervous about going on national TV and identifying a bunch of these. But
okay, well, you're not on national TV. But you're on the Songcraft podcast, which is
similar.
Yeah, just as nerve-wracking. Okay, I'm going to give you an example. This one should be easy for you because this one, I would say, is from our past. Now, just for the sake of this experiment, I didn't download a bunch of clips. I haven't done that. I'm just going to hold up my phone to the mic. So, you know, those of you that are used to pristine audio quality from us, you know, sorry.
You know, so, we're doing what we can.
Yeah, totally.
All right, I'm ready. Okay, that's Black Crowes, Hard to Handle. Yeah.
All right.
Okay.
See, this is interesting, right? Because you would think that the elements of a song,
mm-hmm.
we talk about lyric, we talk about melody, we talk about chord structure.
Yeah.
We never talk about drums.
Right.
And the fact that drums, okay, here's another one.
Africa by Toto.
Not bad. Right? And we're talking about two bands that don't have Jeff Porcaro, I think, would be considered a legendary drummer by some, but we're not talking about, you know, crazy drum histrionics,
right?
You know, you mentioned Rush.
Yeah,
you would think that that's the type of song we talk. Okay, here's the one that made me think of this.
Oof, I don't know if I know that one. One more time. God, I don't know. I'm not placing it.
All right, watch me play the next little part.
All right, MJ, got it.
All right, so see, I think that's a pretty iconic fill.
Yeah.
All right, here's another one.
Okay, Superstition.
See, that one's amazing because I think I could pick that up by the drum sound.
Right, totally.
It sounds like a toy drum kit
in
a garage. All right, here's an interesting one.
I'm not getting this one.
I'm going to keep playing it.
Hot for Teacher.
There you go.
But I still got just from the drums. I just needed the ride cymbal to come in.
Totally. I kind of thought it was a motorcycle engine starting before, but it's actually drums. This is one of my favorites.
Okay, I've got it. Something.
There you go. That's very good. Well done. That's not the only Beatles entry.
All right.
Do you know what the other one is?
That starts with drums.
Yep.
That is Birthday.
Good job. All right.
I think, you know, I said there was a Motown song. I'm thinking of Ain't Too Proud to Beg. I think Ain't Too Proud to Beg has a little drum fill intro.
I know you want to
leave. Yeah. So let's check that one. Let's see if that's right. I know. Yeah.
Starts nice
with,
job.
Starts with a drum fill, yeah.
I'll tell you one that I know doesn't start with drums.
Right.
It starts with the full band, but it's Tom Petty.
Yeah.
You Don't Know How It Feels.
Right. Now, got the harmonica over the drums.
Yeah. Even though that starts with the harmonica and the drums, if someone sat down at a drum set and said, "What song is this?" and just played that drum beat, I would be able to identify it.
Which is insane, by the way, because it's not a complicated beat.
Right.
There's not. It's all about how open the hats are.
Yep.
It's about the way the drum kit is mic'd. It's all that kind of stuff that plays into your mind. Here's one. I always feel like the drum kit of this one just sounds like nothing is quite screwed together.
Right.
Like the drum kit's about to completely fall apart. Tell me if you recognize this one. I had to stop it.
One more time. It sounds like, is it Heart?
It's not Heart.
Okay, I can't place that one.
Here's the next little bit of it.
Kiss. Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah, that does sound like that. It sounds like it's the drum kit is not well. It's like a toy drum kit.
A little rattly. Okay, just a couple more, because I think this is great. You're going to get this one in 1 second.
Okay. Aerosmith.
Yep, Walk This Way. I'm not going to say anything about him. I'm going to start him, but I think this is really interesting. So here we go.
Doot, doot. Steve Miller Band.
Exactly.
Take the Money and Run.
Yep. All right. Now check this out.
Also Steve Miller Band.
Ooh. Dude, how is a Steve Miller Band the only band I could think of that has two of these?
Like, interesting.
Because who is the drummer for the Steve Miller Band?
That's a good point.
I don't know.
Yeah,
who knew that drums were so pivotal to the Steve Miller sound?
Yeah.
There's probably more of them.
Yeah.
So I thought that was an interesting exercise. I spent the morning doing this, going through songs and trying to remember which ones started with drums.
Yeah.
And I think it's just, you know, we talk about songwriting on this podcast.
Yeah.
And I think we are always looking for things that are hooks,
right?
As songwriters.
Yeah.
And I don't think anyone really thinks that like a physical drum beat is a hook.
Yeah.
But it truly can be. That drum beat for Walk This Way is, I would call that iconic.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, absolutely. I want to tell a drummer joke here, but I don't know any that are clean enough to say in this context. Now, it's very interesting though. I think it's a good point and something that we've talked about before of like, where does production begin?
Right.
And now we're really talking about arrangement.
Right.
But man, yeah, I mean I got more of those right than I thought.
Than
I
you
would.
Thought you would.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's not even talking about the songs that don't only start with drums, but you think about the iconic drum fills that come in a song like Smells Like Teen Spirit by Nirvana, you know, after the riff starts blackum, ba-backum, ba-backum, ba-backum.
Yeah.
You know, that
yeah,
fill
yeah.
right there, you know, any fill that you can say out loud,
right?
You can say it, you know.
Yeah, I think the most iconic drum fill of all time has to be In the Air Tonight,
of course,
which is not a complicated drum fill.
No,
it's just boom, boom, ba boom, ba boom, ba boom, bum, bum.
Right,
and but everybody knows it.
And there's an underappreciated drum fill, another Phil Collins one, in the song Against All Odds, which most people might know as Take a Look at Me Now.
Yeah.
But right before the second verse comes in, it goes boom, 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 dun, dun, dun. And it's like you feel the song opening up.
Yeah.
So, you know, Phil obviously was great at that, being a drummer.
Yeah, yeah.
And you expect that from a drummer.
You know, and I'm just veering off the topic of songwriting now, but one of my favorite drum fills of all time is the band's cover of Marvin Gaye's Don't Do It, where they're playing it and Levon is singing and he's playing drums and he does this great thing where he goes, "My biggest mistake was loving you too much," and the drum fill that he's playing while he's singing is just so in the pocket and so cool. It's like, it's the perfect drum fill.
Well, Levon's great too, because we talked about that Kiss kit sounded like it was maybe not screwed together too well. Levon sounds like he's maybe not screwed together too well. You know, like you got to tighten up his elbows a little bit, but it's just so groovy and greasy the way that guy plays.
He's one of my favorite drummers ever. And one of the things that's so great about him is My wife is a drummer, by the way, and she is slightly annoyed by me using this phrase, but I always, you know, talk about he plays on the backside of the beat. And
right.
And she's like, there's really not such a thing as the backside of the beat. And I'm like, but there is that lazy thing, and you hear it like a lot of Southern drummers, you know,
right.
manage to get it. I think it's because it's so hot. But it's like it's on the beat, but it makes you wonder if they're not quite gonna make it.
Right.
And it lands on the backside of that beat, and it's very different than, like, you know, Buck Owens, so I've talked about as one of my favorite artists, but that is like on the front of the beat. The
right.
drums are pushing the song, and then you've got, you know, like the band where you got Levon back there where he's like, he's so laid back and it's so in the pocket and it just feels so good.
Well, and I think we've talked about this before, but there's been some discussion that's how they created basically the Rolling Stones sound. That's why that sound is what it is, because Keith is on the backside of the beat,
yeah,
because of whatever's going through his veins at the moment, you
yeah.
know. And Charlie Watts is kind of like pushing forward,
yeah.
you know. And there is almost like a military, you
right.
know, nature sometimes to the concise way that Charlie Watts would
yeah.
play. And then Keith's on the backside of it, and you put all that together, and you get this awesome swampy Stones thing.
And there's something about, like, Charlie really pushed the beat on the hi-hat, but when he, you know, most drummers, they hit the hat like on every beat, and then they're hitting the hat and the snare. When
yeah.
the snare comes in, hitting at the same time, he would pull off the hat just for that snare, which made the snare really crack.
Yeah.
And so if you listen to his playing, he's playing on the hat every beat until he gets to the snare, and then he pulls back, and it's that split second of pulling
yeah.
back that makes his snare a little bit on the backside of the beat while his hat is pushing the beat, which
yeah.
is amazing.
When I think about Charlie being, you know, on the front of it, I'm thinking about his hat patterns. And you know who must have loved that was the mix engineer, because you've actually got the snare just alone there.
Right.
And if you want, you know, if you want to ride it, whatever, you don't have
yeah.
a hi-hat in the way to deal with. So anyway, I appreciate you indulging me in that. It's got nothing to do with any
nothing,
with what we're talking about today.
Nothing at all.
But, you know, we are the guys that once did a whole conversation on which artists carry their wallet on stage. And it's just in our DNA.
Yeah.
So
we got to talk about this stuff. Well, I'll tell you what's almost as timeless as percussion itself is the musical stylings of Rachel and Villery.
Yeah.
And these guys have done two albums together. And a lot of folks, of course, know Rachel from Lake Street Dive. And we have interviewed Rachel and her bandmate Bridget from mm-hmm. Lake Street Dive on the show before. So this makes a very rare return engagement today, because we've got Rachel and her partner from her other situation. It's not, do you call a duo a band? I don't know.
Apparently you call it a situation.
A situation. It's yeah. She's got Lake Street Dive is one situation.
Yeah.
And Rachel and Villery is another situation.
Yeah.
So she came on to talk with us about the music that she makes with Villery, which is very different than the music that she makes with Lake Street Dive. Villery is the primary songwriter in the duo, but I thought it'd be fun to have them both on, since,
yep.
you know, at this point, Rachel's a friend of the show, right? So, so Villery is kind of talking about songwriting. Rachel has some great stuff about song interpretation, and I believe she joins Natalie Hemby and Brandi Clark as these are now the three people who have ever come on Songcraft twice. So that is an elite.
That's rare air.
Elite group there. But this is one that we actually recorded several months ago. And I think one of the reasons that we haven't posted it yet is you weren't there. And
yeah.
you know, I never shine as bright as when I'm with you.
Yeah, we've done a few of these lately, and there are a couple more coming up where it's just you. And we've done some that are just me.
Yeah.
Not as many. And the reason for that, we could have all the funny reasons, but sometimes we just want to be able to grab an interview when we can.
Yeah.
And if our schedules don't line up, we don't want to miss a chance
yeah.
to speak to some of these great writers. So, you know, it happens every now and then. It reminds us how much we just desperately love each other.
Can barely function
yeah, totally.
Without each other.
But I
kind of kept sitting on this one for a while because their music is so timeless.
Mm.
You know,
it'll always work.
Yeah, yeah. You're like, hey, I mean, and of course they were doing interviews talking about their most recent album. And so at this point, it's still their most recent album, but
yeah.
it's not quite in the immediate after. aftermath like it was the time that we were talking about it, but it still doesn't matter. I would say if you like some of the clips and some of the stuff that you hear today, both the records that Rachel and Villery have done together are very good. They are very much in kind of a timeless mold. They tap into songwriting and performing principles that are, you know, are intertwined with the whole commercial songwriting tradition in America going back decades and decades and decades. And that's what I think is so great about it, is the timelessness. So, hey, it doesn't matter. You know, we're going to talk about drums on a songwriting podcast.
Yeah, man.
We're going to air this interview months after it happened because it's still just as good. Cause you know what? We do what we want.
Yeah. We just wanted to kind of snare you in with that, kick it around a bit, just give you something to hang your hat on, you know, just fill the time.
Yeah.
Sorry. Am I beating a dead horse here?
Yeah, boy. Ugh.
Part two.
Rachel and Villery, welcome to Songcraft.
Thank you.
Great to be here.
Well, Rachel, you are, of course, best known for your work as the lead singer of Lake Street Dive. But you and Villery have been performing together since 2015, which was after the release of your band's breakthrough album, Bad Self-Portraits. Talk a bit about what drew you to this particular partnership just as your band was really taking off, and what kind of artistic fulfillment this project brings that might be different from what you experience in the other setting.
Well, I grew up singing jazz, and primarily jazz from the 30s and the 40s. It was the first style of music that I was attracted to, and so my upbringing, I sort of assumed that I was going to go into jazz. Like, I always wanted to be a singer, even when I was very little. And I sort of fell out of it in the process of being in college. And I was singing jazz during that time and enjoying it, of course. But as far as trying to figure out a career path, I couldn't really see what that would really look like. And so naturally, you know, I graduated and Lake Street Dive took off, and which was amazing. I mean, it took about 10 years, but, you know, it slowly but surely grew into fruition. And it was really just hearing Villery perform jazz music from this time in such an authentic way that sort of struck me. And I said, I feel like I could do this. If Villery could invite me into the fold with him, then we could do it again in a way that's interesting. And it was really just like interesting enough to perform in a tiny bar for people in Brooklyn, you know, for 25 people. I was like, that sounds interesting to me. I wasn't really imagining that we'd ever make a record or two records at that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, kind of expounding on what you just talked about, this is a question really for both of you. Talk a bit about how you actually first met and then began performing together.
I usually make Rachel field this one, but I'll take it this time. Rachel and I met as 18-year-olds. Maybe, were you 17, Rachel, when you started college?
I was, yeah.
Yeah, so she was 17, I was 18. We were little baby people. And she was coming from Tennessee, and I was coming from New York City. And we met in Boston at the New England Conservatory of Music. We weren't really friends initially. I mean, just because I had a hard time kind of warming to people quickly. I don't know if Rachel had that same experience, but it took us many years to kind of find even just a friendship, let alone a musical partnership. So we met there, and I played music with the people that she played music with, which is to say Mike Olson and Michael Calabrese. And I also met Bridget Carney around the same time, and we were also friendly, but not close. And then it was kind of when Rachel moved to New York City and Bridget moved to New York City and Michael Calabrese moved to New York City that we sort of became friends of a closer nature. And then it was still, you know, 5 or 6 years off before we started playing music together.
Well, as Rachel mentioned, initially this wasn't the type of thing where the vision was making records so much as performing live. But then in 2019, you guys did release your debut self-titled album. And with the exception of Nosotros and I Love the Way You're Breaking My Heart, I believe all the songs on that album were written, Villery, by you solo. And I'm curious, were these original songs that you wrote specifically with Rachel's voice in mind, or was this kind of a collection of some songs that you were pulling from that you had written over time?
When I started writing in this style, which is to say, taking heavily from the traditions of the Tin Pan Alley musical scene that existed in the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s. The way I approached it was kind of to say, what's a song that Fats Waller might have sung? What's a song that Ella Fitzgerald might have sung? What's a song that Peggy Lee or Frank Sinatra might have sung? So I was really thinking in my mind, in order to get it to a place that felt accurate to me as far as word choice and as far as note choice and progressions and topics, I really had to focus in on these people that I admired from that period. And then I found that it was easy enough for me to sing them, not doing a Frank impression, but you know, those songs became standards following their treatment by those legends, and then other people were able to interpret it. So it sort of started in my brain as this interpretation that I could hear Billie Holiday singing a song. And then, of course, I never actually got to hear her singing the song, but then I could give myself permission to start reinterpreting it for the real world for my own limited voice as compared to Billie Holiday's. And same way I could hand it over to Rachel and she would interpret it. And sometimes I would say, well, I was kind of thinking of Peggy Lee in this situation, and maybe that would take her to a different place. Again, we're really not trying to like ape the sound of singers of the time, but sometimes it gives you a kind of idea of, oh, tempo or attitude, phrasing. So that's really where it started from. And most of the songs on that first record, Without a Thought for My Heart, was a song I wrote for Peggy Lee. The Laundromat Swing was a song I wrote with the Mills Brothers in mind. And, you know, I could go on and on. But that record, as distinct from this record, which I kind of relaxed into a situation in which I can just kind of hear Rachel's voice and write for her a little bit more.
Yeah, right. That makes sense. Rachel, one of the songs on that first album, and one that you guys actually perform as a duet, is Let's Make Love on This Plane.
Oh, Lindy hopped straight to Gay Paris in 30 hours flat. If he had company, he would never rush like that. This cabin shaken, let's start taking off the plane, oh darling. Let's make love on this plane.
Oh, oh darling, let's make love on this plane.
And that's a song where the syllables don't always land right on the beat, or where you might expect them to. And it's very much jazz singing. There's even a scatting section in that song. And as a songwriting podcast, we talk a lot about how songs are created, but we don't always get to hear about how those creations are then interpreted, or what the how the singer is interacting with that creation in terms of how they present it to the world. How much does Villery leave his songs open to interpretation for you as a performer versus him envisioning a certain way that he might want you to deliver what he's written?
Well, sometimes, as Villery mentioned, it's as simple as mentioning a singer who he was thinking about. And that will automatically lead me down the right path to sort of explore the various ways in which it can be interpreted. And then sometimes it's more of a sort of like a director coaching an actor sort of approach. He kind of talks to me about who they are, what's behind the song, a little bit of a backstory, if you will. And, you know, sometimes we'll even just go through sort of the joke and just be like, well, this is actually the punchline. So, like, if you don't draw this word out, it's actually not going to be as funny, or things like that. I mean, there's a lot of humor, and there's a lot of I've learned sort of comedic timing and singing by learning Villery songs, which I don't think I ever really was trying to do before in any other context.
Right.
And that takes a lot of trial and error and a lot of work with the audience, really, you know, trying it live and saying, oh, I see, they laugh when I put it here on the beat, and they don't laugh when I put it here on the beat, which is pretty interesting. And it's just, it's kind of trial and error, and it's somewhat intuitive. So yeah, we sort of feel it out together. And Villery and I are big processors. Like, I'd say, like, every time we get off stage, we probably talk about the show for, you know, good half hour, 45 minutes.
Interesting.
And because it's such a, you know, an intimate experience, you know, so he was like, oh, I think that went really well, and that went really well, and that didn't quite work for me, and things like that. So, yeah.
Yeah. Villery, I listened to a track on that first record, like, Without a Thought for My Heart. And I noticed the solid time-tested song construction, and specifically, you use perfect rhyme to set up the hook. It's a different setup line each time, whether it be, you know, right from the start, we knew you'd part, I played my part, whatever it is leading up to Without a Thought for My Heart.
We always knew that I was too young for anything beyond just your selfish bit of fun. Right from the start, without a thought for my heart. You held me near and clearly whispered that we should be so glad for the moments that we had. We knew you'd part without a thought for my heart.
I am very much a person who values perfect rhyme. I always feel like a songwriter should go for perfect rhyme first and resort to slant rhyme only if there's not a great perfect rhyme that doesn't sound predictable. But I bring all this up for kind of a weird reason, which is that I understand you spent time busking in the New York subways. And that's the kind of gig that requires you to really grab people's attention in about 2 seconds. And as someone who is very much steeped in that Tin Pan Alley tradition, I'm curious what you learned about song construction through that busking experience, particularly in terms of the kind of songwriting that really hooks people and captures their attention.
That's a very good question. I think there's sort of two levels to it, and the first level is what I like. I think if you're true to your own tastes and you're reflective about what you like about a song, that always is the best starting point for coming across to your audience in 2 seconds. Or, you know, it's funny you say you have 2 seconds to grab them. I was playing in the New York City subway system, so you have about 20 minutes to grab them because, you know, that's how long it takes for a train to come.
Right.
You know, it's kind of... this thing of just being sort of true to your own tastes. And my tastes kind of veer towards language that is itself musical. I like the way that particularly singer-songwriters of the time, people who were writing songs, particularly lyrics, and also sang, how they wrote. Because I think they have a really natural ability to suss out the music in consonants and in vowel selection and, you know, kind of grouping hard vowels, A, I, O, U, you know, U together, and flat vowels, E, together. Kind of, it sets up these beautiful accents. If you're sort of careful with how you set up your vowel structures. So I think that stuff, even though it's quite technical, comes across to people if it's coming across to you in some special way as the singer. But that aside, I think there's something about this music that is, you know, elemental, and it's about love. But it's always about very specific love and you know, what's going on in your life that is worthy of a song. And so you just, you come up with these elemental ideas. Any Little Time is about crying in public. I can't really think of the song that's about, you know, crying in public. There was an old 50s song called Cry, and that's the only one that kind of comes to mind. But anyway, just bringing up these sort of elemental ideas of emotions and how they present themselves in uncomplicated ways can get people to come listen to you and even say, wow, I really felt that.
Yeah.
In the subway.
Sure. Kind of tapping into those universal human experiences. I want to go back just a second to what you said about the musicality of language. And it's very evident to me in your songwriting that you enjoy playing with words and playing with lyrics and almost using the delivery of, you know, certain vowel sounds, like you mentioned, as an instrument in the song itself, that the writing itself can kind of become a part of the performance, so to speak. And you clearly are very much a craftsman in that regard. But there's also this real playfulness with language that reminds me of that classic Tin Pan Alley approach. You know, I listened to a song from that first record, like Alone at Last, and I particularly like that lyric that says, "Once was agoraphobic, Times Square would make me gasp. I let full trains go past. With you, I feel alone at last." And, you know, it's that classic style, but with a bit of a wink. It's reverent. It's also fun. And it's just the way that you play with those words that I think is really cool.
Once was agoraphobic, Times Square would make me gasp. I let full trains go past. With you, I feel alone at last.
I'm playing a lot of music today, but another song that I really love from that first record is De Friends Fall in Love.
Around the world, we've shared these roads together. Every journey is grand when you're holding my hand. Do friends fall in love like this? Love that once was merely warm now blazes with an ardent desire. A touch that once was just a touch burns hotter than a 5-alarm fire. Oh, say you're mine for all our days to follow. What was innocent before has become a grand amour. Two friends fell in love like this.
Rachel, the harmonies that you guys sing together throughout that song just sound effortless. But I would imagine that kind of singing is probably pretty tricky. It's probably not effortless. It's something that that you have to work really hard to execute just right and to be effective in a way that sounds that casual. Talk a bit about Villery's songs in terms of how they might challenge you or stretch you as a singer into some directions that you might not otherwise go.
I think where they challenge me the most is the emotional content, being able to deliver the message of the song in a way that isn't putting my voice first, but also, you know, the singers from the 30s and 40s had very like lush, just like silky sort of sounds. I'm thinking of people like, you know, Julie London and Doris Day and Peggy Lee too. But they did always, I think, put the interpretation of the lyrics first. And I think some that my one of my pitfalls, especially with singing jazz, was almost fully focused around tone, because that's what I was like, that's how it's going to sound correct. That's how it's going to sound like it's from the time, as if the tone is in keeping. And with that focus on tone, I sometimes wouldn't be thinking so much about just making sure that the lyrics were spoken in almost a conversational way, so that the listener is getting those first and foremost. And so I'd say that has been the biggest challenge, and that's been the thing that I've recognized the most about what's important. And it's definitely made me a better singer, I think, overall, this project and singing Villery songs, even with the stuff that I do with Lake Street Dive, I think has improved too, because I've been thinking about songs in those ways. And then, you know, as far as the harmonies are concerned, it's funny. It seems that with our harmony singing, either it works or it doesn't. Usually if Villery writes a song and he's like, could it be a two part? Either I can come sing another harmony part, or I try something and we're like, this sucks, and we move on. We don't really work.
Right.
I mean, it's just like certain melodies work with one other harmony on it, and certain melodies I think don't. Maybe
if we had two other people, maybe we could suffer.
Yeah, exactly. So
it's like one third, instance, above is a strange thing.
Right. Yeah, Do Friends was kind of one of these sort of miraculous songs where Villery wrote it, and then when I came in to sing it with him, the harmony part was pretty much, it was just sort of there, you know, it just existed.
Yeah. Interesting. Villery, I've heard you say before that, De Friends Fall in Love was actually, commissioned by someone, which is kind of like, you know, writing by assignment. Are you someone who likes assignments, who likes deadlines, for example, to motivate you to write, to give you some direction in writing? Or do you kind of prefer a more free-form approach when it comes to your creativity?
I do try to sort of, if I don't have a commission that's due soon, I try to commission my own songs, sort of have a concept, tie one hand behind my back in some way to shrink the number of options and the number of roads that I can walk down. So, you know, Is a Good Man Real, for instance, I was trying to, with that first verse, write something that, like, I didn't know what it was going to be about. I didn't know the phrase Is a Good Man Real. I just wanted to ask a series, or I wanted to posit a series of ideas before I got to the thesis. So the audience is right there with me in that moment of, I don't know what the hell this song is about. You know, saying, so the first words of that song are, I've never known one. What do they do? We've all heard the legends, but can they be true? So those phrases were just things that I was writing, and I had no idea, you know, what am I writing about? A monster? Am I writing about, you know, some sort of mythical being? And then, you know, of course, my instincts for how this would go in that era and, you know, how it would go in a musical mean that it's probably got to be about a guy or a girl. You know, it's got to be about somebody that you love or wish you loved. So then the challenge was kind of bringing it into that. And so I knew I only had one or two lines to get to the thesis once I'd said those three sort of question mark statements. So that's kind of, that's what I'm talking about in terms of tying my hands behind my back, like starting off with a challenge. Can I, you know, as opposed to writing a lot of these songs where the thesis is the first line, the title of the song is the first line, trying to have a situation where the audience is sitting on the edge of their seat being like, I don't know what this song is about before we get to the idea. That was kind of interesting to me. So, you know, I think that's mostly how I work is if I don't have, if I don't have an assignment, I give myself assignments.
Hmm. Yeah. Is a Good Man Real, of course, is from the most recent album, I Love a Love Song. And we've been talking about songs from the first record. So let's dig a little deeper on the most recent album. And I want to stick with Is a Good Man Real for a moment. I love the cleverness of the bridge on that song.
I've never seen a narwhal, the unicorn of the sea. But if God made whales and put horns on the males, maybe he'd put a heart in a guy for me. He don't need money. I'll settle for funny.
People just don't really write songs like that anymore. I mean, it's got that perfect rhyme. It's got the internal rhyme. It's very clever. And to write like that, to write in that style, you really have to soak up those classic songs of the 30s and 40s and 50s. And we're talking about songs that are very much before your time. Talk a bit about how you were able to educate yourself so thoroughly on the music that preceded your lifetime.
Well, I came to fall in love with jazz around the age of 16, maybe 15. I was going to a arts high school in New York City called Fiorello LaGuardia High School. And I came as a guitar student, and there are no guitar lessons there per se. So you're joining orchestras or you're joining the jazz band. And so I joined orchestras as an upright bass player. I learned the upright bass while I was there and played Beethoven and Prokofiev and lots of exciting things. And then in order to have a reason to play guitar at school, I took first a jazz improvisation class and then a jazz theory class. And then I was kind of in the big bands in my junior and senior year. So that's where I fell in love with it. And I really fell hard. I stopped going to class. I started using all my babysitting money to buy CDs at Tower Records and then kind of burn CDs off my friends and, you know, stopped bringing books to school, just brought CDs to school and would cut class into practice rooms and, you know, try to, you know, listen to this music. I was mostly listening to instrumental music. And not really songs. So I caught the jazz bug and was writing instrumental music and then went to college and was writing avant-garde instrumental music. And it wasn't really until like my mid-20s, I had been very into Billie Holiday in that period of high school, but I wasn't really into, you know, Fats Waller a little bit. And it wasn't until my late 20s that I was kind of like listening to that music with a thoughtful ear around what they were doing. And it was sort of, yeah, my mid to late 20s was my full education into this kind of stuff to, you know, I don't know. I don't think I was even thinking about how to write it, just kind of what was going on. Because it is a particular set of little engineering miracles in a lot of these songs. But I think I just listened really hard and I couldn't name a lot of the techniques that they use beyond sort of things of form. If you want, I can talk a little bit about that narwhal bridge and how it came to be, which was not really like focused on those jazz traditions in particular.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd love to hear about it.
So like I was saying about kind of giving myself assignments, I got through the second verse of that song, and it was, and it's kind of all questions. You know, does he try to remember what his old lady said, and on all these things about what the fiction of a good man might be to this woman who has never met one. And so you have this song that's kind of all question marks. So I wanted the bridge to be a definitive statement to open up. But I also wanted to tear myself away from what I had been doing, which was kind of like describing aspects of a human. So I had two goals with the bridge. One was to start it with a definitive statement, and the other was to throw it into the ocean, literally. So I just wrote down the line, "I've never seen a narwhal." And I was like, that's going to be so fun to listen to Rachel sing "I've never seen a narwhal" every night that we play together. That was like, I was already delighted. And so then your task is kind of to take this random statement and crawl back to your thesis. So that's what I'm trying to do for the rest of the bridge is, "I've never seen a narwhal, the unicorn of the sea." Okay, fine. We've established what he is like and where he is. But if God made whales, and that's what a narwhal is a whale, and put horns on the males, great. We're getting somewhere where God has done something to this beast. Maybe he'd put a heart in a guy for me. So we, you know, went from whales to males to guys for me. And now we're back to the thesis. So I try to do things like that of like throwing myself in the deep end in terms of a deep opposite from where I've been and see if I can't crawl back to where I need to be for the final verse.
Yeah. Yeah. That's amazing. I've talked about this on the podcast before, but I heard Bruce Springsteen in an interview with Questlove, and he was talking about that he really learned to write songs by being in a cover band and coming up playing in bars, because in order to play those cover songs in the way that the crowd wanted to hear them, he had to go kind of pick the record apart and figure out what the people were playing on the records, and that by doing that, by deconstructing the records, he was figuring out how good songs were put together. And while his education was kind of in the bars, you guys are both formally trained musicians, but also musicians who have, you know, played in a variety of live settings. And I'm curious, for you, what is it about deconstructing those songs of the past which helps you understand how to best put a song together in the present?
You want to start, Rach?
I'm not sure I know how to answer the question, honestly.
No, you want me to start?
Yours first. Yeah.
Okay, fine. Well, I'll just double back on this idea of knowing what you like kind of comes across to other people. And I think, you know, I listened a lot to my heroes are Michael McDuck Olson and Bridget Carney, as far as this goes. You know, the songs that were early Lake Street Dive songs, I think, were like very built on this idea of writing a Beatles song or writing a doo-wop song, or, you know, and there was like this incredibly original voice coming from this music, and it, even like all the harmonies and all of it, it wasn't just straight nostalgia. It was like very original. And there was something, I remember sitting with McDuck and a bunch of other people in a restaurant when we were like 20 years old, and him saying, "Do you think you could record a record that you could fool people into thinking it was like recorded in like 1945? And we all kind of talked about it, and we were like, "No, I don't think you can, because you can't record that way and you can't write that way." And like, it would just, there would be something about it that would always sound like a little wrong, or maybe 12 things that sounded wrong. But something about that conversation always stuck with me, and I think it must have stuck with McDuck, because he was always sort of pursuing songwriting from the perspective of influenced by the things that he loved and the things that he liked. And the things that he liked kind of came across in this beautiful bloom. And I think that that's the thing. It's like, it's not trying to sound like that thing. It's trying to put across your affection for some aspect of it, and really trying to inhabit your affection for that aspect of it. It keeps your humanity intact when you're making the music, and it also, like, it doesn't try to remake the wheel also, because that's another issue, is like people being like, "No, man, I have to be so original." Mm-hmm. Like, it's like, what does that even mean? Like, how, you're going to be influenced by the things that you're influenced by. So just try to do that with as much love and thoughtfulness as you can.
Yeah. Okay, Rachel, I'm going to let you off the hook with that last question and ask you something a little different. Though you don't write the songs in this particular duo setting, you are a songwriter on some of the Lake Street Dive material. And you talked earlier about how being a vocalist with Villery and singing his songs has impacted some of your approach in the Lake Street Dive setting in terms of how you think about the emotionality of certain lines or deliver certain lines. So I want to kind of reverse that question and ask you the opposite of, because you are a songwriter in Lake Street Dive and being a songwriter and having certain songwriter sensibilities, what do you think that brings to the duo and how you interpret Villery's songs that might be different than somebody who is purely a singer and doesn't write songs in any setting?
Wow, that's a big question. Well, I do feel first and foremost like an interpreter of songs, but before I would identify as a songwriter, even though I do love songwriting and do it as much as I can with Lake Street Dive. But primarily what I do in that band is sing the other songwriter's songs. I would say that how I think about it as far as the thing that sort of it exists with the sort of the interpreting of the songs and also the songwriting of the songs and also being able to understand how to approach someone else's is sort of finding what the sort of true kernel is from the songwriter. And this is something that Bridget actually mentions a lot, which is that she likes to have every song start with one true thing and then everything else can be a fiction. And I think that that is the case with Villery's songs. I think there is one true thing that's really coming from his own experience, and then he can write any sort of fiction around it. And I think that's the case with all the songwriters in Lake Street Dive. And whether or not they feel the need to explain maybe the specific experience that it comes from, you can kind of sense. And I think even over the years, the songs that have always floated to the top have been those songs and the ones that we haven't played. Maybe sometimes we usually go into like a new album with 20, 30 more songs than are needed. And I think the ones that kind of, float to the top are the ones that have that one true thing sort of imbued in them. And so, that's kind of how I approach both things, both the songwriting and the understanding of the interpretation of the song is what's the experience. And, you don't really need to tell the audience anything else about it. You just need to kind of understand it yourself.
That makes so much sense to me to hear you talking about viewing yourself as an interpreter. And I think even about Lake Street Dive, you guys do a lot of cover songs, but you always kind of put your own spin on it. And, there's so much to be said for interpretation. I think about a song like What a Wonderful World, which is a good song. But then when Louis Armstrong sings it, his interpretation just supercharges it and it becomes this definitive thing. And I don't think, anyone's going to top that interpretation of that song. And as somebody who's a trained jazz singer, you've had plenty of experience interpreting classics from the Great American Songbook. But that also means that you've interpreted songs by a whole lot of writers who have been dead for a long time. And working with Villery and working with Lake Street Dive means that you're working with someone who is standing right next to you. And unlike other writers whose songs you've interpreted over the years, you have the writer right there. You can consult them. And as you mentioned earlier, Villery is there to say, hey, if you hit it this way, it's funnier.
Mm-hmm.
So in both Lake Street Dive and in the duo, I would imagine that having the writer standing right next to you is a huge benefit for someone who is really committed to that idea of playing the role of interpreter.
Yeah, it definitely is helpful to be close to the source. I mean, you can ask them a question directly about the song. And I think there's just something kind of direct and magical about knowing the songwriter. You know, it's like Villery and I hang out a lot. I know what his life is like. So when he gives me a song, I can kind of, you know, I can hear his voice. And it does make me think about, you know, the songs, singing jazz and interpreting standards, and usually any standard that I would be interpreting, I've heard 10 different versions of. And sometimes feeling a little lost in that pursuit of how to put my own stamp on it, to find myself in such a absurdly spoiled and fortunate position to be working with so many different songwriters that are my dear friends, and to get to interpret the songs, it really makes you understand what it may have been like, you know, for jazz singers in the 30s and 40s, sort of getting a song for the first time and being like, this one's for you. Like, we were thinking of your voice. It really is a beautiful, direct relationship. And, you know, I think about, like, Dionne Warwick and Burt Bacharach. You know, it's like probably after a certain point, like, Burt Bacharach was thinking about her voice when he wrote a song. And then she knew that, and then she would get a song. And, you know, it's a beautiful marriage. And it's like, I don't think anyone's going to be able to really sing a Burt Bacharach song like Dionne is. Like, you can try, but, you know.
Right, right. Well, one of the songs that you do not interpret, meaning Villery sings it, is Any Little Time, which is the opening track on the most recent record.
It mystifies the happy guy whose life was half the reason why a heart can break at any little time. Fearsome tears come, let them flow. Any little time could be the bottom of the ninth, or in the highest tent in Kathmandu. If you don't love me, then every little time I'll cry. All the monks and all the umps will know for sure I'm in the dumps. A heart can break at any little time.
And Villery, I've heard you say that that song was inspired by, quote, Mercer-esque lingual acrobatics. And Johnny Mercer, of course, was both a songwriter and performer. And we've talked a good bit about your influences, but we haven't specifically talked about Johnny Mercer. And I hear a lot of Johnny Mercer influence in your songs. Can you just talk a bit about his influence on your sensibilities?
I think he really typifies this thing of being very literate and like knowing the things that you can quote and everybody kind of understands it, principally, you know, the Bible and Shakespeare and, you know, all these things that are kind of part of the canon of literature. But then he's also very vernacular, and he's got this built-in sort of natural speech and natural word choice that is like very, you know, available to the commoner. And I just love that sort of, it's such a heady mix of language to be able to kind of pull from everything that you need to pull from in order to be. Because lyric writing is just a process of extreme efficiency in which you have to put across something in an interesting way in a limited number of syllables, and you kind of, as you're writing, you're hemming yourself in by limiting the number of syllables. You're saying, okay, well, this is how long a line is, and you know that's more or less determined by whatever you wrote first. You know, you're not really like thinking about giving yourself as much room as you can, so you're sort of hemming yourself in, and then you got to kind of just make it sing. And I think he's a real master of that. There's something about it that sounds very much like quickly written, efficiently done, masterfully done, that I really admire and, you know, am always thinking about.
Rachel, Villery has said of your performance of the song Even in the Evening that, quote, in fewer than 4 minutes, she powerfully and subtly emotes reverie, disappointment, exhaustion, impatience, heartache, longing, derision, understanding, acceptance, regret, and in the end, an explicit threat of revenge. I listened to that song and Is a Good Man Real, which are both songs written by a man from the perspective of a woman for a woman to sing. Is it natural for you to inhabit the characters that spring from Villery's songwriting imagination? I guess what I'm asking is, when it comes to the female perspective, does he get it right?
Yes, I think he does. He gets it right. I think sometimes, Villery, you get good, really good feedback from Molly, from your fiance too. Sometimes she'll come in while you're writing a song and tell you that this female perspective is a little stereotypical and
yeah, sometimes. And sometimes I don't make the change.
Right. Yeah.
Is a Good Man Real was something that she said was like, she was like, oh, it's a little complainy. And I was like, I think she's just having a hard time, this lady.
Yeah. Yeah, but no, I think I do. I think he gets it right.
Yeah.
But I think I just want to step in and say, I mean, you know, not to go there with it, but I think there's something about Even in the Evening that could be sung by a man about a man. I don't know if you could sing it as well as by a man about a woman, but there are certainly women who are working too much and losing interest in the relationship, and guys who are like, hey, I thought this was going well, you know? So, you know, I don't think there's necessarily anything super gendered about any of it, but I think it speaks to Rachel's interpretation of it, that it feels like, ugh, this is a woman, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because she's putting herself into it. And I think that there's probably a man out there who could interpret it, and you would say, wow, yeah, this is like, you know, and change the hymns to hers, I guess. But, you know, even if it was a guy singing about a guy, I think you could say, yeah, I see that relationship.
Well, I think if there's a song on the new album that harkens back to Do Friends Fall in Love, it would be Just Two, which has that similar close harmony. And each line phrase of the song is exactly two syllables, which feels like a fun nod to the title, Just Two. Yeah. And I would guess that that was probably a pretty fun song to write.
Of all the lips I know I've kissed, I can't just two. A sea of eyes I've hypnotized, but I can see just two.
I was inspired by Lyle Brewer. He opened for us at some point, or maybe I opened for him, I can't remember. And he was introducing a song, and he said he was inspired by the wind chimes outside his window, which only had two notes, and I can't remember, it might have even been the interval of a second. And he said, well, maybe I could write a song that was just the interval of a second the whole time. And he wrote a very pretty song. And so, you know, I'm always on the lookout for little tie your hand behind your back limitations. And so I said, okay, well, maybe I could. The challenge of writing a song that is only two notes is that basically it means that your harmony has to be interesting enough that, you know, because if we just sang Just Two a cappella right now, you would be like, this is not a song. but, you know, the harmony contextualizes those notes and makes it something. So, you know, it's in a way, it's kind of interesting because it takes the pressure off the melody and puts it on the harmony. And then, of course, you have the other requirement of giving it lyrics that work. And it was fun. I think it happened pretty quickly. The nice thing about such a limitation is that's it. You know, you know, of all the lips I know, I've kissed, I can recall, just two. You know, it's almost like a weird, drunken limerick or something like that. It's a very simple childhood poem, I think.
Yeah. It takes great skill to write something that sounds that simple, though.
Ah, thank you. Yeah, well, I mean, I think songwriters should think a lot about giving themselves limitations before they sit down, because, you know, the most daunting element of writing is knowing that your blank sheet of paper could be anything. And, you know, so giving yourself a break by saying, no, it could only be this, is a big help, I think.
Yeah. It's always great on the show when we have guests, whose music I'm already a fan of. And, Rachel, when you and Bridget came on, previously, I was already into Lake Street Dive. I've had the first Rachel and Villery album on CD, 'cause I'm old school, since it initially came out. And even though I know that this is the same woman singing in both of these settings, I don't really consciously think about that, when I'm listening to one or the other, because it is so different. But I would say that on the most recent duo record you guys have done, the song Hate is the Basis of Love is the closest thing that I hear to kind of the Lake Street Dive voice. And I hear it in that intro the first verse section. But then it changes directions and it joyously embraces this very traditional sounding music and lyric formulation that, you know, is much more in the style of music that we've been talking about.
People long to find true love, they're searching every day. They wonder at the mystery of the fire that never burns away. Perhaps they say the spark that sets it springs from the things lovers like. On your first date, I advocate that you focus on all the many things you both hate. Hate is the basis of love.
Despising is the wise thing, for seeing if you see things eye to eye.
Imagine hating raisins, now everything has raisins, 'cause you fell for a raisin, crazy fool.
And in your shared apartment.
And while that construction is very much traditional, there's still this updated sensibility in the lyric that sort of, there's an interplay between the two. And I listened to the lyric, if only you'd been straighter, said, honey, I'm a hater. If you want to know what floats my boat, then ask what gets my goat. You know, get my goat is an old fashioned term, but Johnny Mercer wouldn't have known the term hater. So this song, kind of in every way, has one foot in tradition and one foot in the modern world. And Rachel, I guess we have a bit more sense of the breadth of your musical style and some of the different things that have influenced you, because we hear a whole other side of you in Lake Street Dive. But Villery, I'm curious for you, is what we hear in the duo, I mean, is this your world, or is there other music that you also kind of pursue outside of this particular structure?
I would say it's just one facet of a love of songwriting that is pretty obsessive, and I mean, if I'm being honest, it is geared towards older things, but I love Paul Simon, who's still with us, and I love a lot of country singers, and, you know, Willie Nelson in particular. I am geared towards sort of older ideas, Leonard Cohen, but I love all kinds of songwriting, and I love the the facets of them, that their personality. I was talking to a student about, you know, the magic of Paul Simon is that he's really not describing things in his head. He's not describing like emotional terrain. He's describing interpersonal relationships down to kind of conversations, you know, like Still Crazy After All These Years is literally describing, you know, an interaction and, you know, like a single interaction in a very specific way. And, you know, I think that that's pretty magical and kind of unusual. So, yeah, I would say I'm in love with songwriting. So I listen to a lot of different practicers of that art.
Right, right. The only cover song on the new album is Goodnight, My Love, which was written by Mac David and Harry Revel in the 1930s. And you've called it, quote, a perfect song. I want to ask you, what is it about that song that makes it perfect? And can you think of any other song that you would put in that same category, or one that's particularly special to you that stands out that you really admire?
Well, I use that word very freely, I think sometimes people are stingy with their praise, but I think it's a perfect song because Rachel and I have really discovered it's unusual in that we sing it. Rachel sings it down, the full form, and then we modulate, and I sing it again, the full form. And it can bear that. And how many songs can you say that about that just, you know, you're hearing the same exact words again, and they're interpreted differently by different singers. But that could be a very silly-sounding thing. So it's got kind of a brevity that is perfect. Its harmonic motion is interesting, and it's expressing this very nice sentiment very simply, which is to say, we've had a great time and now I'm going to bed. I'm really looking forward to seeing you tomorrow, but I am going to bed. So I don't know. I think maybe the thing that's coming to mind right now is Rudy Valley's Deep Night. I think that's a perfect song, in that it's sort of just describing the night and not really getting deeper than that, but it's incredible poetry and harmonically it's insane. And that's a great song.
Hmm.
Perfect.
All right, Rachel, I'll ask you the same question. Is there a song that you would call the perfect song, or a song that, you know, you just have a ton of reverence for and you consider like, oh man, I wish I'd written that, or that song just blows me away?
I think Villery referenced one of my favorite songs of all time, which is Still Crazy After All These Years by Paul Simon. If I had to listen to one song over and over and over again for the rest of my life, I could probably listen to that song. And I think that the beauty of a 3.5-minute pop song and just like the beauty of the art form compared to so many other art forms, which can do so many things, the beauty of a song is that it's a microscope into a single moment. And it takes something that could be small and fleeting in your day, and it opens up the profoundness of these very, very small moments. A great song doesn't have to be about anything, but like in Still Crazy After All These Years, running into somebody on the street that you haven't seen in a long time, boom, that's a song. And you can talk about just that one little feeling, and you'll want to listen to it over and over and over again. And just saying goodnight to somebody and that you're sleepy, but you're going to miss them while you're asleep. That's it. That's a song. You can sing it over and over again. And I think that there's just something so beautiful about finding small moments to write about.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, the most recent album is called I Love a Love Song. That record and your debut self-titled album are both fantastic. So I want to encourage people to dive deep on those if they have not already done so. And I think the thing that really comes across with you guys is, you know, when I'm listening to your music, it's just evident how much you love great songs, and you're obviously both also great performers, and it's just wonderful music and a joy to listen to. So thank you guys for the great music, and thanks for talking with us today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for your questions.
Thanks for listening. To make sure you don't miss an episode of Songcraft, please take a moment right now to subscribe to the show via Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
You can keep up with us on Instagram at Songcraft Conversations or Facebook at Songcraft Show. To join our team and help support our content, become a Songcraft patron at patreon.com. Visit patreon.com/songcraftshow.
And you can always find us at songcraftshow.com.